messages on screen to written audio that eventual evaporation becomes available. This station will now see you on the
Welcome to the Casual Preppers Podcast. Here are your hosts, Cam and Kobe.
Welcome to the Casual Preppers Podcast, the only place for prepping, survival, and entertainment. We are your hosts, Cameron and Kobe, and we are ready to bring survival goodness direct to your dirty little ear holes.
I think we literally are the only place for entertainment.
Yeah, the only place you can get it.
On Earth right now.
Yeah, absolutely. Cameron, again, we have another podcast that's a little bit different today, right?
There's some high girth in this episode.
There's a
large amount of girth in this one.
Yeah, we got a lot of stuff to talk about. What are we talking about, though? What is it?
So we're kind of continuing with the Cold War stuff, mm-hmm. but now we're moving into, okay, civilians, they're prepared. Now we're going to talk about, what's the government going to do?
Yeah.
How are we going to keep that government functioning?
Yep.
How do they even care about us? They probably don't.
They don't, no.
So we're going to talk about what they're going
to
do.
Yep. Continuity of government today. So it should be pretty interesting. We got a ton to get to, so we're going to cut a lot of the crap to get to the information. But first, guys, today's podcast is brought to you by TacPack, the only monthly tactical subscription box with useful professional-grade stuff inside. Get 10% off your first TacPack with our code, CasualPreppers, at TacPack.com. And join the thousands of satisfied subscribers today. That is 10% off with our code, CasualPreppers, at TacPack.com.
Yeah, it's only 90% that you have to pay.
Yeah, geez, that's a good percentage. Good gracious. Go check them out, TacPack.com. Mm-hmm. So today, Cameron, we're talking about COG. A lot of people say COG. What is COG?
Well, it's a little gear that goes into the system like clock.
Yeah, continuity of government is what it means. And so basically what that is the continuity of government program ensures the survival of essential federal government leaders and agencies in the event of a severe crisis. And
because all are important in that system.
They absolutely
are. One.
And so this sort of, again, came back to the Cold War. It kind of had its beginnings there. They weren't thinking about this back in the Civil War. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. They just weren't. So nuclear weapons basically changed the way that the government looks at how they keep going in the event of a war, a crisis, or anything like that.
You don't want to cut the head off.
No, or any of it off. They don't want to cut anything off. The head's very important.
The tail flipping around.
Yeah, you look stupid. So let's talk about kind of the history and the beginnings of it. Kennedy basically created the program, and this was back in 1962. And so the stated purpose of COG was to shield.
You did that before I did.
Was to shield the essential infrastructure of the United States government from destruction, permitting its continued operation and authority in a time of crisis, and protect the government from the illegal assumption of power by rival foreign powers or anti-government organizations.
Kind of blows my mind that two world wars had passed before they were like, we should decide how to keep this government going. What do you think, everybody?
That is a good idea.
We've had it
on our list for like 100 years. I know. Time to go. So, yeah, so the government acknowledged plans to construct secret facilities, we'll talk about those, and implement a COG strategy, but the details and locations of COG operations were meant to remain secret, and a lot of times they have been secret, and a lot of this is very secret, like stuff we probably don't even know is going on, but we gathered as much information as we could that's available, and there's some really cool stuff.
There is some freaking cool stuff.
Yeah, so one of the first orders of COG was to ensure the survival of the president. Or the executive authority, right? That's what you said. You don't want to cut the head off because he's the guy that's in charge of everything, right?
That would pretty much stop the country from functioning very well.
It'd be very hard.
Who's in charge now?
I don't know. So in 1947, the line of succession to the presidency was expanded. So this was actually before Kennedy actually made the COG plans, but more firmly established. The line of succession.
So they at least had this.
Yeah, they had this. The line of succession moved first to the vice president, as we all know, and then to the Speaker of the House.
This wasn't until 47?
47. Well, it was expanded in 47.
Okay, so they did have some.
The vice president.
Obviously, okay.
Yeah. And then the president pro tem of the Senate, and then proceeds through the nine members of the president's cabinet, right? And then in 2007, the National Security Presidential Directive 51, not to be confused with 50, this is 51, okay, directs the geographic dispersion of leadership, staff, and infrastructure in order to maintain the functions of the United States government in the event of the nation's capital is decapitated by a terrorist attack.
See?
I know. You know what you're talking about.
That's what I'm talking about.
Yeah, so buried deep in that plan, the National Continuity Plan is the strategy for the mass evacuation and relocation of every federal government agency, including the White House and the military, in response to an exceptional catastrophic event within the National Capital Region. And so every federal agency is required to have like a very, very detailed plan, and it's called a co-op plan, but it's the Continuity of Operations Plan, basically, is what that is. So following any sort of a catastrophic national emergency, the president or his successor can authorize the establishment of a temporary shadow government.
Mm.
Doesn't that sound kind of cool?
They're operating by a shadow government.
Yeah, to maintain control of the essential functions of the federal government. So President Bush actually activated this on September 11th, 2001, shortly after the attack on the World Trade Center. So this was actually enacted in 2001, which cool. is kind of cool to actually think about.
It's not very long ago.
No, every federal agency has designated key individuals to be part of the Emergency Relocation Group. There's like so many acronyms. Like my head is exploding with acronyms.
It's insane. Yeah.
Like ERG, COP, COG, FEMA. I mean, there's just like over and over.
There's tons.
I don't get it. So these ERGs, or emergency relocation groups, are assigned to an alternate secure location on a rotating basis and are ready to take over the duty of supporting the national essential functions of this nation in an emergency. So the plans are insanely detailed,
yeah.
And they're constantly changing. Like they said, it's rotating. It's really, really crazy. So talking about the Presidential Succession Act of 47, so this is kind of how it looks. I don't know if I'll go through all this, but like we said, Vice President, Speaker of the House, President of the Senate, Secretary of State, Treasury, Defense, General, Interior, Agriculture, and it kind of goes down. There's like a list of almost 20 of these, and at the very end is Secretary of Homeland Security. So all of those people are in line to be president.
That's crazy.
Depending on who
imagine
dies.
If it got to a point, it's like, well, their Secretary of Agriculture is running the country right now.
Yeah.
it's crazy.
It's absolutely possible.
Yeah.
So in 2012, President Obama issued two executive orders that would greatly expand the presidential powers in the event of a national emergency. So this is key to listen to, because I think this part right here is crazy. In March of 2012, executive order gives the president the authority to commandeer all U.S. domestic resources, including food and water, and seize all energy and transportation infrastructure within the United States. That is freaking crazy, and he was able to do this by executive order. The order also allows authorities in the U.S. government to force its citizens to fulfill labor requirements for the purpose of national defense.
Wow.
Basically make us all slaves.
Yeah.
Is what they're saying.
Yeah.
Right?
That's crazy. So that goes along kind of with that martial law.
It really does, yeah.
Like, guess what? You're going to be watching airplanes all day.
Yeah. You're part of, what was it called?
I can't remember. Yeah.
Skywatch. I'm like, all right.
I'll do that one.
That
and you
good.
Are sandbags. Yeah. Oh, dang it.
Damn. I want Skywatch.
We want the whole coast to be sandbagged.
Yeah. And so that is just really, really crazy. And also, it gives the Department of Homeland Security authority over private communication networks in emergency situations.
Wow.
So our local company here could be taken over by the U.S. government like that in an emergency.
That's so crazy.
That's just...
Guess what? We control you now.
Yeah. Yeah. No more unlimited data plans. Not happening.
Guess what? You're going down 0.5 megabytes up, yeah. Down.
Seriously, that's what they could do. Yeah, is, you know, to give
priority to their
functions. So it's kind of crazy.
Greedy.
So one of the other things that they've set aside is something called Designated Survivor. And I don't know if you've seen. There's a show on Fox. Uh-huh. I think it's on Fox. It's got the vampire guy in it. You know.
Yeah.
Kiefer's in it. Kiefer Sutherland's the president. So he was actually the designated survivor.
He was a young man when he died as a vampire.
He was, yeah. So in the United States, a designated survivor, or sometimes they call it designated successor, is an individual in the presidential line of succession. So that whole line of people that I talked about in the president's cabinet, any one of these people can be the designated survivor. And it's usually a member of the United States cabinet who is arranged to be at a physically distant, secure, and undisclosed location when the president, the vice president, and other officials in the line of succession are gathered at a single location. So this happens every single year at the State of the Union address, right? So everybody is all in one place when that happens. So if a bomb goes off, pretty much like everybody in the government is dead. Like everybody that's anybody is dead, right? I mean, all the judges are there from the Supreme Court, yeah, everybody crazy. In Congress. That's a lot. The House of Representatives, the Senate, you know, pretty much everybody in the cabinet. Like this year, he chose Secretary of Energy Rick Perry. So he could have been the president.
That's
like that.
That's nuts.
It's just crazy to think about. So
before that, they're like, I don't want to go to this. Come on. Designated survivors. Sweet. I just got a text. I could
popcorn in a bunker, baby. That's what I'm doing.
During that, he's just like sitting in a theater watching the movie.
I know.
Oh, I don't have to do anything today.
It was the greatest. So, so they'll go to a bunker in case that building blows up. They're going to live, and they will now be in charge of...
Did they actually stick them down in the bunker?
Uh-huh. Yeah, they put them in bunkers usually.
Dang.
Yep. They're
makes
very,
sense.
Yeah.
It wipe does out the sense. Surface.
Mm-hmm. So, they have some very, very detailed plans, especially when it comes to the president. And we're going to talk about every orifice of this freaking plan because there's a whole bunch of different parts to it. So we're going to talk a little bit right now about evacuating the president. So most of the time, the president is in the White House, right? That's his house. That's where the president lives, Cameron.
I believe so.
Yeah, that's where he's at. It's a White House.
So I've heard.
Washington, D.C. So the president would evacuate via the White House tunnel system. Did you know they had that?
Mm-hmm.
You do now. The Marine One hangar to the Marine One hangar at the Anacostia Naval Support Facility. So that's where they keep old Marine One, apparently.
And that's a chopper.
Yeah, it's a chopper. His ultimate destination would be on board the E-4B National Airborne Operations Center. And I think you know a little bit about that.
Yeah,
right,
I'll
Cameron?
Talk a little more about the specifics of transportation
yep.
beyond that.
Mm-hmm. And so that's basically, it's a crazy militarized
So they put him in the plane. Air as fast as possible.
Yeah, they get him
safest
right in the
place.
Yep, exactly. So the tunnel systems, the work first began on the secret White House underground tunnel system back in the 1950s under Truman. Truman got a lot of this stuff started.
I know, that's crazy.
Well, I mean, it's the 50s. That's when the Cold War was going.
When they knew that.
When the bomb
was being developed, they're like, ugh.
Yeah, this is bad.
This looks horrible. Why don't we bury ourselves?
Yeah, so during that time, a tunnel was built underneath to connect the West Wing to the East Wing and provide access to the bomb shelter that they had under there. And then in 1987, another tunnel was built during the Reagan administration to protect the president in the event of a terrorist attack. This tunnel allows the president to access a secret staircase outside the Oval Office by pressing on a wall panel to reveal and open a secret door.
That's cool.
Good gracious, that's cool. President Reagan was like, you make it cool. Seriously. I don't want no stupid looking door. I want it. The secret
door. I
want
to be escorted. I want this whole bookshelf to fold down in the staircase.
I want mist to come up underneath it. And I want red lights to blink and whatnot. He sounds
I want
like
robots to authorize me to go down.
Yeah, robot. Eye scanning robot, you know. Welcome, Mr. President.
Thank
Welcome
you.
To the apocalypse.
Thank you. This is pretty cool.
I like this. Apparently Reagan was a redneck, so everybody's a redneck in our stories.
Yeah, why not?
Yeah. So the passageway at the bottom of the stairs led to a closet near the president's private elevator in the basement of the residence. There's also a known tunnel leading from the basement of the East Wing to the basement of the Treasury Building, which was built by FDR as an air raid shelter. The passageway provides pedestrian access between the White House and the old Executive Office Building. Apparently, they actually built this at an angle because, you know, FDR was in a wheelchair, so he could just get down there and just fly down that sucker. Can you imagine?
Cut him loose.
Cut him loose. He's got apocalypse
sparking
coming.
Off the walls.
I just imagine
I'm heading in
FDR just like banging around in his chair, you know.
Just puts a helmet on and like just goes down the
hall. Yeah. We got to do another test run.
So it's connected
run.
To the Treasury?
Yeah, it went to the Treasury building.
We'll make sure we have access to that.
They had an air raid shelter down there.
God,
I just thought that was so
awesome.
I
wonder
awesome.
How complex that is down in there.
Like, I know. Like
I'm lost.
Tunnels upon tunnels. Upon
How'd I end
tunnels?
Up in Mexico?
Yeah, exactly. So those are just some of the things they have like right there at the White House. And there's a few more tunnels that go to the Blair House, the Vice President's residence, Camp David, and the Pentagon. There's just a lot of... They say there's tunnels going everywhere, but there's not like it's not been confirmed, right? So
yeah.
they're just like rumors.
I believe it.
Yep. So there's a thing called CogCon. You ever heard CogCon before?
Yeah, it's like a real exciting event that comes every
San Diego.
Talks about clocks and all the different gears.
Yeah.
Everybody loves this conference.
CogCon 2019. So CogCon is actually, it stands for Continuity of Government Readiness Condition. This is really similar to DEFCON, right? We've all seen that in the movies.
Yes. Yep.
We're going to DEFCON 5.
What?
DEFCON 15. DEFCON.
I believe you mean CogCon.
I believe you mean CogCon.
It's not as exciting.
No, it's really not, is it? So it's the United States government's readiness level, roughly analogous to, like they said, DEFCON alert system. Tracking the readiness of the government in the event of an emergency, the system was introduced in the National Security Presidential Directive 51, which George W. Bush put into plan. I don't know what the hell I'm saying. So there's four different levels of CogCon. CogCon 4, it's normal peacetime operations. That's where we're probably at right now. Everybody's good.
We're CogCon 4.
Everybody's just like sitting back smoking a cigar. I mean, if you work for the government, you ain't doing much. So that's where you're at right now. And then CogCon 3 is a state of heightened readiness with some government officials required to notify a watch office as to their location. So a couple times a day they have to say, this is where I'm at, this is where I'm going. During the U.S. State of the Union address, a CogCon is raised to this level, and a cabinet member is a designated survivor.
Oh, it does. It gets raised to that.
It gets raised to that.
Together. That makes sense.
So that was just, what, last week or something,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah. So we went to CogCon 3, everybody.
Yep, we
had
did.
Had no idea.
Then there's CogCon 2. This is where shit gets nutty.
Oh.
So it calls for deployment to a relocation facility with 4 hours' notice. So at this level, each agency splits into three teams, an A team, a B team, and a C team, and they all go to different locations. So
Alpha,
each,
Beta, yeah, Charlie.
Yeah, each government agency splits up. You know, every single agency does that. So it's like the Treasury team, you know.
You're with me.
You're with me.
You're Treasury, you're with Team Beta.
Yeah,
get out of here.
So that's when stuff starts getting nutty. And then there's CogCon 1. And this calls for the United States government to be relocated to secure fully staffed bunkers.
Dang.
And this is places like Mount Weather. And
you'll have some details more
on
those.
Yeah, we're going to have some more details on those things. So that's CogCon. That's kind of just saying the state of readiness and putting these plans into place.
That's cool.
Really interesting.
It's crazy.
Stuff.
It's really not that old in the history of the United States to have all this in place. That tells you how much more. How much matter the mad world has become.
Yeah, it's madder and madder as
way
we go.
Madder.
Hey, Cameron, real quick, can I talk about ServivaGuard?
Go ahead.
ServivaGuard is the ultimate vitamin formula for emergency preparedness, survival, and life. You will have confidence in the knowledge that you are getting 100% of all 13 essential vitamins and 8 essential minerals, 11 super antioxidants, healthy omega-3 fish oils, and a unique proprietary NutriPrep blend for a physical and mental emergency preparedness. CogCon 1, son. We are confident that you will experience a better overall sense of well-being, more energy with enhanced alertness, and increased ability to concentrate with greater endurance, and you will be best prepared physically and emotionally for whatever situations you face, no matter how extreme. Use coupon code CASUALPREPPERS for 20% off your order at ServivaGuard.com.
Right on.
I guarantee you that the government...
That's 80%.
Good
that
crap.
You have to pay.
Yeah.
Only.
And this is like long shelf life freaking vitamins.
You would think with everything they have in there that it would just be like an MRE sized pill.
I know.
I've been chewing on it all week.
Yeah.
Got so much good stuff in there.
Nummy nums.
Numbers.
So yeah, ServivaGuard.
So Kobe talked about the transport of the president so quickly, you know, books out of the... You know,
yeah.
I don't know, skateboards down the the little hallway there.
They got a longboard.
Jumps on the heli, the AKA Marine One, and then he goes and he's up in the air. So I wanted to just kind of do a little background on Air Force One and how that, where it came into play. So presidential transport, FDR was the first president to fly in an aircraft while in office.
That's crazy.
I know. I was like, it's not that long ago. But planes aren't that old. You know what I mean?
Planes aren't really that old.
So, and it was called the Douglas Dolphin. And it was actually it was in service from 1933 to 1939. And then, I don't know what happened to it. So, during World War II, it was changed to the Dixie Clipper. It was Boeing 314.
I'm going to ride a Dixie Clipper.
Let's get on over to that war. Let's ride the Dixie Clipper. Because they found, obviously, that the ocean was real susceptible to submarines. Who knew? You know, Germany, I think, basically
Yeah.
Just littered the whole bottom of the Atlantic Ocean.
Yeah.
So they were like, screw it, let's get in the air. 314, Dixie Clippers, go. then that was, so that was during World War II. The United States Air Force wanted a more secure plane because these were commercial planes that the president traveled in, which is funny because we went back to that. So they had the idea of let's do the C-87, and it was nicknamed Guess Where Two. So not Air Force One, but it was Guess Where Two, which is way more awesome. So like
Guess Where the number two?
Yeah, Guess Where number two. Guess Where Two we're going.
Yeah, Guess Where Two we going.
No,
it Dick's was... Clipper on his way.
I wonder, it never said anything about Guess Where Two that I could... Or Guess Where One. Nobody knows where that one is. Guess Where.
Guess Where.
The bottom of the ocean. But yeah, so that's an awesome name, though.
I know,
it really. President's in there, guess where? Nobody knows where it's at.
It's like the who's on first thing.
Yeah.
Guess where the plane's at?
What?
Yeah, just guess where.
Nobody knows. this was a C-87. So if you look at images of the C-87, it was very similar to a bomber plane. So they kind of were thinking, probably getting the wrong message here. President's coming in. That's just our president coming in. Why is there 17 of them up there? That's the president's escort. Don't worry about it. Just bomb the piss out of whatever you're coming in. So I was like, oh, that's interesting. That it's like they saw it as like too much of an aggressive looking plane. They're like, nah. Yeah.
We need something that looks nice.
President coming in a freaking B-52 bomber. They're like, nah, maybe we'll change it up. So
that's funny.
So it didn't stick as the presidential plane. They then made it a C-54 Skymaster was designated the presidential transport plane, a Douglas C-54. Mm. So it was nicknamed Sacred Crow, I think. Is it Sacred Cow?
Sacred Cow, yeah.
Yeah, Sacred Cow, sorry. Uh-huh. I remember I was like, Scarecrow, when I first looked at that. Oh. That'd be cool. But it included a sleeping area, radio telephone, retractable elevator for Roosevelt to get in. Mm-hmm. Sadly. It was only used once before he died. So they got it all decked out, made it like the official presidential plane, and he only rode in it once.
It's all handicap compliant, and the next guy doesn't even have it. We spent an extra $800,000.
Why is his door so big? Oh, I forgot.
Oh, yeah. Rest in peace.
This elevator is super slow to get up in here.
Why is everything on an incline?
Rest in peace. Well, I appreciate your plane.
I appreciate your plane. Roll down on my butt from one room to the other.
Where's my seat? It's just an open spot for a wheelchair.
It is like his plaque.
We haven't put it in
president's
there.
Seat. Oh, man.
We're not trying
are
to
we
be.
Making fun of people with polio now?
I guess we kind of are. Anyway, the calls. All right. So after Roosevelt died, Truman instead used a C, which I found this kind of a, I found this plane kind of interesting. I'm like, shouldn't this have been a plane that, see what the name is?
Yeah.
This probably should have been Roosevelt's plane.
Yeah.
So this was a C-118 Liftmaster. Came, but, you know, not the one that Roosevelt.
Hey, President, we finally got your plane in. Oh, wait, you're a different guy. What's going on?
Hey, can we get the C-18 Liftmaster model? The president's going to need it. Oh, he passed away.
Wheelchair compliant.
So Truman, he nicknamed this Independence, where he was from. Mm. And this one was Bad A. It had the bald eagle painted on the nose.
Oh, that's awesome.
Which I'm like, why don't they leave that? That's so much cooler.
Yeah.
Now it just got a bunch of lines and blue and white.
Blue.
Boring.
Presidential seal and stuff.
So yeah, that was a Bad A plane. The call sign for the president's craft was changed with Eisenhower because there was a confusion up in the air where they were just calling out the plane's name, you know, like C-118's coming on in.
Yeah.
And it confused it with a regular commercial jet. So that's when Eisenhower's like, we got to change this. And that was when Air Force One call name was created.
Old Dwiggett had a good idea.
So Eisenhower, he introduced multiple planes so that you had alternatives, you know. Mm-hmm. I want to take that one. four prop planes for presidential travel.
Oh, they were still using prop planes at that
time. Yeah, yep. Wow. And he added the air-to-ground telephone and air-to-ground teletype machine. So he had he started to implement better communication with ground service or ground forces and everything. In 1958, Boeing created the 707, which became the president's jet, and that's when now we have stuck with jet planes for the president. John F. Kennedy marked the jet age. That's when he started flying around everywhere. Anyways, the plane then moved to a SAM 2600, and this was JFK to Clinton. That was kind of a long period of one jet. The 2700 was Nixon's, which was pretty much the same. And now we have the Boeing VC-25A. But it was actually designed by the interior was designed by Nancy Reagan.
Oh, she's multi-talented.
And he never flew in it.
That's interesting.
I know. I thought it was kind of
a funny
story. It was in development, you know, and then when Bush, H.W. Bush got in, that's when it was done.
So talking about call signs, I heard this story in this book I was reading. So Nixon was in Air Force One, right? Right as he had just resigned and he got into Air Force One and he was heading back home, right? So he's up there, he's drinking and, you know, whatever. And then back at the White House, old Gerald Ford was getting swore in. So he got swore in. And so then the call sign immediately changed from Air Force One to some random call sign. Like it just like, you know what I mean? So like they called in like right then.
That's
said,
crazy.
So it's not Air Force One because the president's not there.
He's not anymore. In that. No kidding. Yeah. That's crazy. I didn't know that.
That's nuts, huh?
So they changed it to A-ho.
Yeah.
Liar. Liar one's up in the air.
Not a crook one. Anyways.
No kidding. Like it's kind of mid-travel.
Mid-travel, yeah.
By the way, you're not president anymore. The jets are like,
yeah.
Just leave him out there. The pilot's like, well, this isn't important anymore.
Yeah.
We're going to make it. It's going to be a 6-stop flight now.
Don't give him any more peanuts.
Start picking up passengers and everybody.
Don't give him any more peanuts. He's done.
Hey, he's done. No more. Yeah. So we really got to see how all of this worked on the 11th of September, 2001. Mm-hmm. So President Bush was at an event for the school at Emma E. Booker Elementary School in Sarasota, Florida, after the attack on the World Trade Center. He took off. They got him immediately to a VC-25, which they always have on standby, and he was up in the air super fast.
Yeah.
And he was with Colonel Mark Tillman, the senior pilot for Air Force One. So he always has that with him so that they can immediately get him to and up in the air, and he was fast. Kind of an interesting event while he was up in there. They had a plane that had turned off its communication system, and they had warned it. You know, they're like, this is Air Force One, and it wasn't responding. It was like coming right for him. So they had no idea. They were like, they've had all this that they were unexpected.
Holy
they thought
crap.
This plane was coming toward, and it was a commercial plane with people on it. But, you know, all those other things that had happened, they had to suspect that it was.
Yeah.
So anyways, at that point, they called up the Air Force to support, and then they flew out over the Gulf of Mexico to see if it would stay on path, and it just stayed on its own path.
Oh, my gosh.
Come to find out, it turned off its transmitter, which they could have gotten blown out of the sky.
Oh, my gosh. That's crazy.
So to all you pilots out there, don't turn off transmitters.
Yeah.
So anyways, they came around. They did not go back to Washington, D.C. They landed at the Nebraska Air Force Base off it. So, and that's where he gave his speech. So anyway, currently in development is, do you remember that whole fiasco about making a new Air Force One and Trump's like, no, it's a waste of money, blah, blah, blah. Anyways, it is in development to change to the 747-8, which is the new presidential aircraft. I thought that's kind of ironic. So Air Force One and all this was kind of Cold War. Mm-hmm. These two that have been developed, the 747-8, they were for a Russian commercial airliner.
Oh,
they
really?
They canceled it, and they kept them. So they have both of them in the desert right now, keeping them out of the weather, but they're going to be turned into...
That's crazy.
I was like, kind of funny. Yeah. They were going to be Russian planes, and now... Nope, we're keeping those.
Never mind, we're
keeping them. Anyways, just real quick on some transportation, presidential, some old-fashioned transportation. I just kind of was specific on Air Force One. So the aircraft's where I focus most, because that's exactly where they're going to put the president up out of the way of. And these planes, I'll go into a little more detail, but they're EMP proof. They've been, you know, they're pretty decked out.
Yeah.
Back in the day, they used carriages. Studebaker Corporation had one for Abraham Lincoln, which took him to the Ford's Theater the night he was assassinated.
Yep.
And then he was taken to his grave on a train, which was also the United States executive coach, which he did not want to ride in. I didn't know that while he was alive.
I didn't know that
Lincoln
either.
Kind of found it as too much. You know, he was like, no, but it was the, I think they used that train, the Lincoln special, for his funeral train, which is kind of interesting. But there was only, you know, there wasn't a lot of transport other than just basic carriages, obviously, back in the day. So boats were part of a presidential transportation from 1880 to 1977. Some of them were the USS Dispatch, the USS Dolphin, Mayflower, Sequoia. Is it Potomac? How do you say that?
I don't know.
Anyway, and then syphilis. No, the USS Sylph, and then the Williamsburg, which was, I think the Sequoia was Carter's yacht, and it's that was the last one to be in use for the presidential boats. But anyway, yeah, there you go. There's some like basics on there. So today, some of the call signs: Air Force One is the U.S. Air Force aircraft with president on board. Marine One is the helicopter. Mm-hmm. That's a Navy helicopter. They do have an Army one, but it's basically the Marine One is the main transport vehicle for the president. Then the Navy One. This was only designated once when George W. Bush took the S-3 Viking airplane and flew. So it was a naval aircraft out to the aircraft carrier USS Abraham Lincoln.
Yeah.
So it's only been used once, which is kind of crazy. Coast Guard 1, not ever used, but Vice President used Coast Guard 2 in 2009. And then Executive 1 is any civilian aircraft carrying the president. So maybe that's what.
Yeah.
They went to executive. Nixon must have got Executive 1 when he. Anyway.
Oh, that's interesting.
So there's some basics on Air Force One and what the president uses to get up and out of all the chaos.
We didn't go into cars very much.
No, I didn't. Yeah, I didn't
so touch on those. There's just like an interesting story about the
motorcade
first time.
And stuff.
Yeah, so like the first time, let's see, I think this was right after December 7th, 1941. FDR he was going in a parade or he was doing something. I don't remember the exact things, but they didn't have a car and they had to have something that was like bulletproof because they were like freaked out now, right? This stuff was going to happen.
World War II and all these
so they didn't know Hitler what to do. Sure. And it would take a certain amount of time to get one of those produced, right? So what they ended up doing is using Al Capone's car because he had
did?
Yeah, so they actually got his car and FDR drove that.
No joke. That's bad.
But apparently it had like a drop top and he put the top down anyway, so it didn't really like help that much. But it was just interesting that like they didn't have anything ready. So like, Al Capone, we got his car. It's like, all right, let's do it.
The mafia is more protected than the president.
So it's pretty interesting.
Hey, don't mind those Tommy guns pushing the side president. Get on back.
No big deal. No, big
we're all rednecks here.
Yeah, get your chair right in here. We're gonna be all right. We got a sidecar
just
for you.
Holding onto a rope, getting towed by it. I'll just wave.
Slow down, my wheels are wobbling.
These barbersaw wheels aren't handling the road very good. Man, we're
starting to get the death wobble.
If you're in a wheelchair, it's cool.
It's all right.
My mom's practically there. Anyway.
So talking about these presidents getting in the air with these crazy planes and different types of transportation. Where are they going to go? You know, there's a lot of different places they can go. They can stay in the air sometimes for weeks if they have to.
They can refuel in the air.
Yep. Yeah, they can refuel in the air. So it's kind of crazy. But there's a lot of different facilities that they've built that they can go to. There's places like Mount Weather. There's Site R, which I believe is Raven Rock. There's Camp David. They
it's
have
called Site R, Raven Rock.
Well, there's a whole bunch of different names for it. Okay. So Site R is one of the names. There's bunkers at Air Force bases. So I just want to talk quickly about some of those bunkers that are available and some of those operation centers. The first one is the Presidential Emergency Operations Center, or PEOC, as it's more aptly named. So basically, this was originally constructed by FDR again during World War II. It was built to withstand nuclear weapons, and it was likely to be the president's evacuation point if there was an ICBM, an invasion, a terrorist attack, zombie apocalypse, anything like that. This is where they're going to go. So it's not the same thing as the Situation Room. A lot of people think that that's what the Situation Room is, but it isn't the same. The Situation Room is in the basement of the West Wing. It does have several television sets, telephones, communication systems, all those types of things to keep the government going during an emergency. Or if there's like during a breach of the White House, that's where they would probably go. The president and other protectees will be relocated to the executive briefing room next to the PEOC.
Didn't you say, just to bring it up, didn't you talk about like the access codes to like nuclear strikes are still like dated back to 1970. Remember you saying like,
man, I don't remember
the computer systems or something.
Oh yeah,
super freaking old,
like
still.
Really old computers. Yeah, that was. We talked about that a long time
launch.
Ago. Yeah,
launch.
Floppy disk
crashed. Hold on.
Yeah, there's something like
somebody's got number munchers in here.
Yeah, somebody like some of the systems are super old, but I'm guessing that those ones are changed.
I would hope so. Yeah.
So actually, during,
better have LED TVs in there
during September 11th. Dick Cheney. Lynn Cheney, Condoleezza Rice, all those guys. They went into the PEOC. That's where they went because they were all at the White House when that happened. Another facility is Raven Rock, the one I was just talking about. It's known by a lot of names, Site R, the AGCC, the ANMCC, the MCCC, the USAGRR.
I mean, no kidding, it's got all those names.
The Underground Pentagon, the Little Pentagon, the Backup Pentagon, the Rock, or Harry's Hole. That's another one of them. They call it, well, because Harry Truman's the one that made it. Hey, I'm going into Harry's Hole this weekend.
What?
Yeah.
Excuse me?
my name's Harry. So in 1950, Truman approved the construction of a deep underground facility that could be used as a relocation site for the Pentagon. So this is basically where those people at the Pentagon are going to head when SHTF, right? 1.5 million cubic yards of super hard greenstone granite rock was secretly blasted out and hauled away in 10 months. I don't know how you secretly blast rock, but you do it in secret. Don't tell anybody. Everybody be quiet.
Come on.
That one was way too loud. Come on, guys.
Start shooting guns.
I know.
You didn't hear nothing.
We're just out here hunting rabbits.
We're just trying some explosive ammo out.
Five separate three-story buildings were built deep inside the Raven Rock Mountain located on the Pennsylvania-Maryland border. The buildings look like ordinary office buildings set inside a hollowed-out cavern deep inside the mountain. The underground complex has roads and parking areas big enough to accommodate trucks and buses. Site R is completely self-sufficient with two power plants to generate electricity, multiple underground water reservoirs, and a sophisticated ventilation system. The facility can operate for at least 30 days in a buttoned-up position and can accommodate 3,000 persons in an emergency. That's freaking crazy.
Is this the one that has the sea of diesel?
There's several of them that do. I don't know if this one does. I think that might be Cheyenne. I'll have to look at that.
Okay, there's a lot of places on Earth that I'd love to visit.
Oh, that's one.
This would be amazing.
Oh, my gosh.
I'm going to check Expedia for any deals.
There's one of these that we can visit. Remember, I sent it to you the other day.
Oh, yeah. That would be
awesome. We're going to do it.
That'd be so amazing to go down in one of these suckers.
So by April of 1954, the Little Pentagon development had cost $35 million. And that's in 1954.
Oh, my gosh.
I don't even know what that would be
today. Billion
today. But it's a lot, yeah.
Probably a month's wages of Zuckerberg.
Trump. Yeah. 265,000 square foot bunker, 650 feet beneath the summit of Raven Rock. It's just crazy. Like we said, it has living quarters, a medical facility, dining facility, fitness center, barbershop, chapel. Starbucks, and a convenience
Walmart,
store.
Walmart, Target.
And underground reservoirs hold millions of gallons of water. So that's just one of them.
Wow.
Another one is Mount Weather, and this
Imagine
is a big
if,
one.
If you're a Starbucks employee, you're like, yep, yeah, I work down in Raven Rock.
I'm on Harry's Hole.
I got
Hole.
Weekends. Sucks.
I got the night shift in Harry's Hole.
Where are you working? Yep. I got a late shift in Harry's Hole tonight.
Everybody likes their job down there. So Mount Weather is another big one. This is
the barber's like sitting
ain't
around.
Nobody here to get his hair cut.
Man.
Dick Cheney was brought to Mount Weather. This is on 9/11. So he was originally brought down into the presidential.
Oh, he was, huh?
Yeah, and then he was moved to Mount Weather. This is in close proximity to the Capitol.
So I didn't see, did Bush ever go into any bunker?
I don't think
he just
did.
Was up in the air, huh?
I think so, yeah. Mount Weather is in close proximity to the Capitol. The Mount Weather Emergency Operations Center, it spans 564 acres in Virginia, and it's another one of those COG centers. It's run by the Department of Homeland Security and FEMA.
Oh, nice.
The site remained, this is kind of funny, the site remained secret until TWA Flight 514 crashed nearby in 1974. Nobody had any idea it was there until the plane crashed.
Wow.
Yeah, and it was revealed that Mount Weather had served as a bunker for the President of the United States. The Washington Post later reported that the facility was used by the helicopter evacuated congressional leadership following September 11, 2001 in New York City. So that's pretty interesting. But this one, it has an office and warehouse space, dormitory, training room, conference room with the capability to hold up to 125 people, a cafe that seats 280 people, a fully equipped fire department, ambulance Ooh. Service operated and staffed by FEMA firefighters. A health unit staffed by medical personnel, federal police force providing 24-hour, 7-day-a-week security, a motor pool, shuttle services, courier services, and local supply pickups.
I wonder how all that works. Do you think they have those people have like their regular jobs just their local, and then I don't know. Move them all in at the you know.
I'm not sure.
Drop of a hat.
Yeah, possibly.
Like, by the way, you got to go to work down deep inside.
Mount Weather has its own leaders, its own police and fire departments, and no, and even has some of its own laws inside of it.
Dormitory.
No one's ever been allowed.
Hey, lights out, everybody. It's 8 o'clock.
Time to sleep. No one's ever been in, but in 91, Time Magazine published an expose after talking to one of the facility's retired engineers. He described a sprawling bunker complete with mainframe computers, air circulation pumps, and a television and radio studio for post-nuclear presidential broadcasts.
No one's ever been allowed to tour, huh?
Yeah, and the National Gallery of Art
There's a Playboy shoot down in there.
The National Gallery of Art is rumored to have developed a program to transport valuable paintings to the bunker in the event of a disaster. So that's where they think they're going to take those. So NORAD, that's another one of these. This is Cheyenne Mountain. This is the one I think you're thinking about.
Yeah, I think
about.
It is, yep.
So this was built in the 50s. The government decided to build a hardened command center for a control center as a defense against long-range Soviet bombers. It was built inside Cheyenne Mountain near Colorado Springs. Housing other military operations included the U.S. Strategic Command, U.S. Air Force Space Command, and U.S. Northern Command. There are 15 buildings inside the mountain. That's insane. 1 mile inside from the opening and 2,000 feet down from the top of the mountain. You can't even just walk in there. You have to take a bus from the opening. That's insane. The buildings are on 1,300 giant springs. So that's so that and everything is built 18 inches from the wall. So if there's an earthquake or a blast, the whole thing will move.
Yeah, I've heard that. Like if you're in a cave, like torn a cave and there's an earthquake, it moves with the earth so you don't feel it.
There's
2,000 feet.
That's a long way.
Keep digging until you hit lava, and then just plug it up.
Exactly. There are two 23-ton blast doors between the main tunnel and the office buildings.
Jeez.
Yeah, that's pretty crazy. So
wasn't that in the last Star Wars?
I think so. So during the Cold War, one of those blast doors was always shut. They would never have both of them open. So if you were going in, you'd have to go through one blast door, open the other
like
one.
Like an airtight chamber.
Yeah, exactly. There are the workers in Cheyenne Mountain don't have windows with offices because all they would see is granite, obviously. however, they have some perks inside the mountain, like a workout facility, a spin gym, hospital,
just
chapel.
Open your blinds. Ow! Ain't nothing out there.
Weather outside looks nice. So there are five lakes inside the mountain. One lake is filled with diesel fuel, and it's sealed behind a closed wall. Can you imagine a lake of diesel? That lake is really stinky today. One is used for drinking water, so don't mix those two lakes up. The other three lakes are industrial lakes. The water in the industrial lakes is used during peacetime for firefighting or whatever is needed.
What?
Yeah. They're just like industrial water. Like, you know, they're not drinking water.
Okay. Yeah. Potable water.
Potable water, yeah. It's built to handle an EMP. So if there's an EMP, everything down there is hardened, and it's safe and good to go.
I bet, man. It's got to be 2,000 feet. Yay. Yep.
And this is the same one that you saw on War Games, the movie from 1984 or whatever that was. I don't know. There's another one that's called Mount Pony in Culpeper, Virginia. I'm not going to get into that too much other than it's 75 miles south of Washington. It's for the Federal Reserve, and they basically have $4 billion in there. Yeah, a bunch of it's $2 bills because nobody was using those, so they just kept them in there. Thought it was kind of funny.
You're gonna burn it all? Nah, put it in Mount Pony.
Put it in Mount Pony. It'll be good. So this is the one I want to talk about is Greenbrier. That's the one I sent you. You can actually go tour right now.
That's cool.
Yeah, Project Greek Island or Greenbrier was a covert agreement between the U.S. government and the Greenbrier Resort in West Virginia, and this was in the 50s. The hotel was to serve as the government continuity destination for the legislative branch. So this is a huge resort, and they were getting ready to do a remodel, and the government came and said, all right, I got a deal for you. We will do your remodel completely, but we're building a bunker underneath it.
Oh, yeah. That's,
so
I remember you mentioned
nobody
that
really
on
knew.
Podcast.
Yeah, nobody really knew that it was happening, and so they're just like, all right, we're going to build this bunker.
That's so cool.
So it was able to accommodate two auditoriums within the bunker that held 470 people, and basically, it took 30 years for people to even know it was there.
Wow.
Nobody knew.
Impressive.
So there's sleeping quarters, a medical facility, advanced air filtration system, broadcast center. It possesses concrete doors more than 1 meter thick. This part's kind of cool. The bunker was maintained and staffed by government employees posing as television specialists from a fictitious company. Project Greek Island was eventually exposed by a major national newspaper article and decommissioned as a result. Yeah, so they basically made this fake company.
That's crazy.
And they actually did the television work for the whole Greenbrier Resort, but their main job was maintaining this big bunker facility, which is kind of crazy.
What are you guys doing here? We're from NBC.
NBC.
Yeah. NBC? No, NBC. We're just starting up.
Yeah. So, yeah, it was called Forsyth Associates. And they basically just had like a telephone at some empty office building in D.C. Forsyth. Yeah, it's kind of crazy. So, anyways, there's a ton of crazy bunkers for these COG plans. And that one was to save, you know, Congress. So, yeah. Stuff goes down. They all go down there and they can still make laws and govern the United States. It's kind of crazy.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Keep making those laws. That's great.
Yes, sir.
So, you know, I'm going to go ahead and throw in advertisement right here. Why not?
Go ahead, man. Do whatever you
want.
So,
survival boxes. Have you ever heard of them, Colby? Heard of them?
Yes.
They are the only subscription box packed with all the essential survival supplies that you need to prep for surviving disasters, emergencies, or your next outdoor adventure. There are many different boxes.
I think the government should get a subscription. They should.
There's a bunker subscription box.
Yeah,
that's exactly. The one we're gonna send out bricks. And
there's
stuff.
Like a whole bunch of. That's right. I forgot about that.
It's bags of cement. So you can order the survival food, water, and gear required for your survival plan. Sign up today to get survival boxers.
Boxers.
You're gonna love boxers. Delivered to your doorstep or bunker door every month. No contracts. Cancel whenever you want. Hmm. Use promo code CASUALPREPPERS for 10% off your first box on any subscription or store order at survivalbox.com. Check them out. Seriously, we love them. They're so cool.
But use our code if you're gonna do it.
Yeah,
don't be a dummy.
No need to pay 100%, only 90%.
That's right.
I've thrown out a lot of percentages today. I know you're all confused.
Feels like statistics.
It's hard
class.
To break it down.
Yeah.
So during the event of whatever, you know, nuclear attack, so communications is key. Reestablishing communications is one of the most critical components not only of a disaster, only of disaster relief efforts, but also homeland security, irregular warfare, and defense operations. So you sever the communications, you got a lot of problems.
A ton of problems.
A lot of problems.
And it was a problem.
Yeah. So I wanted to just talk about some of the old stuff during the Cold War that were implemented to kind of help civilians as well as, you know, how to detect a detonation maybe quicker than by, you know, telecommunications or whatever you do.
Yeah.
So they had the bomb alarm system, which was a little box that had a light on top, and it was in the U.S. and the U.K. network of optical bang meter sensors, but with an H in there.
Hey, baby, I want to make that bang meter go off big time tonight.
What are we going to call this? To detect a nuclear bomb? Bang meter. That's a good one.
That's called a bang meter. Put it next to my bed.
Put it on a bedpost.
Yeah.
So,
baby, you make my bang meter go off.
It was intended to confirm.
B-H-A-N-G.
Yeah.
I like that.
I know. Then your wife won't think that you're dirty.
Yeah.
Let's not be dirty about it.
It's really spelled B-H-A.
Yeah, it has an H in there. Yeah. Behang meter.
Behang.
They were intended to confirm the detonation of an enemy nuclear weapon near cities or military installations. So they would be sensitive to the flash, and then they would send out the communication that there was a detected nuclear bomb explosion.
That's crazy.
I know. It's kind of weird. They had them in Greenland, too. The other thing was the National Emergency Alarm Repeater, which is a little 2 to 3 inch box that was plugged in to the standard power outlet, and it would receive special signal sent over electrical transmission lines. It got taken out of service when the emergency broadcast system came into play. But the thing about it was the NIR was independent of any the television and radio, so it actually was actually a better system, but it just fell out of use, and they took them all and just got rid of them all after.
I'd like to have one of those.
I know, me too. The other thing, the ACE High, this was more of a NATO radio communication system. that dates back to 1956. This was kind of more of a joint effort for Europe and the United States to kind of communicate over over the countries for any of that crap to happen. This one I thought was interesting. The Mobile Electronics Rocket 6A, or the MER-6A, or Emergency Rocket Communication System, ERCS.
Mm.
So this was basically a radio transmitter that they mounted on top of a Blue Scout rocket and would shoot it up in the air.
What?
I don't know how this couldn't be mistaken, you know? They're like, Russia's like, they shot the missile up in the air. Oh, what is that?
That sounds like, I can't ever do that. Austrian or something.
What is this system? But they would shoot it up, and it would basically, you know, with the elevation and altitude, it would be able to broadcast, had clear signal. But I'm like, man, whoa, to be shooting a rocket off during the Cold War, wouldn't that give the wrong impression?
It might.
Don't worry, those aren't coming at you. We're testing our communications. It's like, holy crap.
Yeah.
So anyway, but yeah, they really do have, they had a couple of different communication devices that were mounted on rockets.
That's crazy.
We'll just get it up as high as possible. Shoot it way up in the air.
Yeah. I'm putting it on the moon, maybe.
If they detect that we shot a missile, I don't think they're going to.
No biggie.
They're not going to worry. We'll let them know it's communication only. Then there's the DDN, the Defense Data Network. It's a computer network that the United States Department of Defense used from 83 to 95.
Wow.
Then the Defense Message System, the DMS, basically email type of thing, directory services in the United States Department of Defense. It's actually still kind of used today. The Lashup Radar Network. So there was like a ridiculous amount of radar systems that they tried to implement to detect missiles and incoming aircrafts and things like that. They called it like a radar fence, you know, that would, and it all came back from World War II, from, you know, what British created, and they kind of tried to expand it to make it the best way to detect and report that there was an immediate attack. There's the Minimum Essential Emergency Communication Network, the MEESINN. And then the Ground Wave Emergency Network, or GWEN. So these are just different ways that they were, all these different communication systems to detect as quick as possible any nuclear strike. The North Atlantic Radio System, NARS, this one I've heard of, you know, it's a tropospheric scattered communication sites throughout Iceland and, you know, across basically over the Atlantic to kind of pick up anything. The only thing is a lot of these weren't implemented in Alaska.
Oh, really?
Which is super frustrating for, like, Alaska was pretty pissed about it.
Yeah.
But they had all these, like, different defense systems, detections, but Alaska was, like, left out in the cold. Literally.
Literally.
But I was like, that's weird.
That is weird.
The most likely spot for them to try and attack or invade, and they're like, screw it. We'll just focus on the inner mainland.
Like 94 people up there. There's no worry about them.
I know. The Eskimos are screwed. They're basically using Canada as a
buffer,
body dummy. Put them in front. And then the Strategic Air Command was both United States Department of Defense, Specified Command, United States Air Force, Major, and then the Major Command, MAGCOM. MAGCOM, I don't know. Responsible for Cold War command and control of two of the three components of the military's strategic nuclear strike forces, also the nuclear triad. What am I talking about? Which consisted of land-based strategic bomber aircrafts, intercontinental ballistic missiles, and then the submarine-launched ballistic missiles. So that was the three. Anyways, following Desert Storm, the dissolution of the Soviet Union, and the de facto ended the Cold War, President George H.W. And Dick Cheney directed the SAC to take all bombers and refueling aircraft and ICBMs offline. Anyway, there's a bunch of jumping around of names and acronyms and all that crap that basically led to the development of the United States Strategic Command, the USS STRATCOM, which is what we have today. And it's a great one. It has been true and proven. So it's headquartered out of Nebraska, off at Air Force Base, responsible for strategic deterrence, global strike, and operating the Defense Department's global information grid. So it's broken up into a lot of different areas of the United States defense. The Global Operations Center, or GOC, is the nerve of the USS STRATCOM. and is the mechanism by which is exercised operational command and control of the nation's global strategic forces from that area. Now, it has a connection to the USS. Okay. So the Strategic Command Airborne Command Post, also called Looking Glass, it allows the communication between that Air Force base, the USS Stratcom, and the air.
Oh, okay.
So yeah. Looking Glass, real quick, the code name for an airborne command control center operated by the United States, it was... It's an E-6B Boeing. This actually can, the president can actually board this thing as well.
Mm-hmm.
But it has basically all command units within it. It's basically a mirror, and that's why they call it a looking glass, to mirror the command post on the ground.
Yeah.
It does both. So if you got the president up in the air, that's usually up in the air at the same time. This is insane to me. So the EC-135 looking glass aircraft was airborne for 24 hours for 29 years.
That's insane.
Just barely have they just kept it on the ground. I'm like, good.
So they had two of them, or two or three of them,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, they do. They have four.
Oh, four, okay, now. Yeah. So one would be in the air and it'd be ready to land. The other one would have to be up before it would land. Yeah. It's insane.
I'm like, they were always a command center just flying around.
I can't imagine how much we spent doing that.
Oh, my gosh. So they're grounded now. They have them ready to fly at any point. You know, one thing that was interesting, I might mention it down here later, but I guess the Air Force One has a special system in it that it can take off like literally vertical.
I've heard about that.
Like they said that it is insane how fast it can get up to altitude of like 10, 20,000 feet, like a fighter jet.
Yeah.
I'm like, that's insane. Anyway, they get the looking glass, which is basically mimics what's on the ground for the operations center for strategic command. So all the planes communicate. They all have these really fancy communication systems. So that's how they've kind of developed over time. We went from like some more civilian stuff. We don't have a lot now other than the emergency broadcast.
Yeah, there's not much.
Communication system is highly complex and sophisticated between all the aircrafts and the president and ground center command. So just real quick on Air Force One, The Air Force One they just remodeled them and put on, there's like these little humps you can see on Air Force One, and that's the like the brain of all the communications. They just updated those, and the new humps feature a multi-role tactical common data link, which is the MRTCDL, probably in your latest iPhone, I don't know.
Yeah, probably.
But this is kind of cool. This communication device uses KU band line of sight channels, and every device that actually has access to internet or cellular can access this. So if for some reason everything got wiped out and somebody was using a cell phone to communicate with the airplane, well, Nightwatch is the other one, and I'll tell you real quick what that is. But yeah, any of those, either the Nightwatch, which is the E4 Advanced Airborne Command Post, that's the one that it's commonly the other airplane, the Air Force One, instead of Air Force One, which is more civilian based.
Mm-hmm.
The E4 Advanced Airborne Command Post is a military based one that the president also has a suite, and it's protected from EMPs.
Oh, cool.
That one is called Night Watch. And then the Looking Glass is more the basic big sucker that just always is up. He's not as likely to be on that one, but can be. Anyways, they have these updated communication devices where they can communicate with the ground via cell phone, iPad, whatever it is, to keep in contact with the ground forces while they're up in the air. And then, so Nightwatch, I thought was kind of interesting. It originates from the richly detailed Rembrandt painting, The Nightwatch, that depicts local town folks protecting a town. That's where they
named it that. Yeah.
So. Anyway, so you've got Air Force One, that's right, usually the VC-25, and then you've got, I know I wanted to look at that picture.
I don't know how to look it up.
Then they have the E-6, which is the looking glass that's basically a flying military Air Force base, and then you've got the E-4 Night Watch. So yeah, you've got all these planes. I think there's four Air Force One, two Air Force One. There's always one on backup, one in the air.
Yeah.
And you've got four of these Night Watch.
Jeez.
And then you have the
the looking glass.
The looking glass that's like always ready and standby. I think there's two or three of those, but
that's insane.
So it's pretty insane. I mean, the communication system is obviously the highest priority for the US government, and they have in every way, in every form, a way to communicate with the ground. If, you know, no matter what, it gets wiped out, those bunkers can still communicate with the president up in the air.
That's awesome.
Pretty
that's
fascinating.
Crazy. Yeah.
So what we have as the public is basically emergency broadcast system or the national warning system. Which is still cool.
I mean, it's a good thing.
And it's, I mean, it's a lot more sophisticated than just what it seems.
Yeah.
And it's actually operated and fully funded by the FEMA. So our Homeland Security and Defense. Today, the system consists of what is essentially 2,200 plus telephone party line.
Really?
Party line.
That's crazy.
So anyway, a little bit on the communication side of
That's nuts, man. So early COG, there's been a lot of crazy things that have happened throughout the development of COG procedures and things like that. These are just a few things that I thought were really, really interesting. So the post office was going to be the agency, in case anything happened, that would be in charge of registering the dead and figuring out who was still alive.
Oh, wow.
So that was kind of their, you know, in a disaster or in nuclear war situation, they were going to register the dead in part because the office, the post office knows where people live and they understand who was left. You know, it makes sense, right?
I don't want to go to that mailbox if they're gone or dead.
So you would like arrive at a refugee camp after your cities had been destroyed, and you wouldn't have been handed, and you would have been handed a form 801 from the post office, which were pre-printed in millions and millions of quantities and located in post office around the country throughout the Cold War in the event of an emergency.
I wondered how they were going to try and keep tabs on every human being still alive.
Yep, and so then the Park Service would actually been the agency that would have been running, in many cases, the refugee camps, because the thinking was that the Park Service land would be largely untouched by nuclear war, which again, makes sense.
You're going to live in Arches National Park.
Exactly. And so not even nuclear war was going to stop taxes, Cameron. The IRS, the IRS had all their plans for how they would levy taxes on nuclear damaged property and how they would raise revenue to keep the government going. So even if it was damaged by nuclear war, they were still going to tax it in some way. That is freaking nuts.
That is
the
nuts.
Federal Reserve built a bunker in Mount Pony. We talked about that, where they kept $2 billion in cash, and would have been that would have been enough money to keep the economy going for 18 months, which was the length of time.
So they kept, do they not have that, or has it been relocated or allocated somewhere else?
They still have that.
It is still there.
Yeah, it's a different amount of cash now, but
$2 bills.
Yeah, a lot. $2 bills. The National Archives sat down and decided that they would have, and in the event of a nuclear attack, they would save the Declaration of Independence before they saved the Constitution. So there was like an order of which, how they would save our founding documents. Yeah.
Huh.
And the Library of Congress sat down and ranked their collection and decided that they would save the Gettysburg Address before they saved George Washington's military commission. So the Library of Congress has like a list of what gets saved first, you know, in the event.
And I mean, not that those aren't important.
Yeah,
we spent tax dollars for people to sit down and decide.
Yeah,
which one's going first?
What they figure though is it's sort of like, you know, if those things at least survive, they feel like
the hope and the
hope, you
morale
know,
of the United
survive.
States. It's like the flag still.
It's the same thing. Yeah,
gotcha.
You know, if like, oh man, all our arts,
we are
gone,
not
all our founding documents
dismembered.
Are gone. Yeah. And the last thing, throughout the Cold War, there was even a specially trained team of park rangers in Philadelphia whose job it was to evacuate the Liberty Bell in the event of a Soviet threat.
Oh, yeah, you were saying, that's crazy.
And so they had a place that they would take it up in the mountains in this little bunker, and that was their only job. There was like three or four Park Service guys that they were going to go do that. Isn't that nuts?
That's nuts.
That's freaking
Honey,
nuts.
Honey, here's the directions to the bunker. I got to go take care of the bell.
Yeah, exactly. So, guys, that's what we have today
That's an insane COG. History.
I know. Isn't that fun stuff, though?
I love the fact that it's like you're devastated sitting down in a bunker with my family. Guess what? It's the IRS. You haven't paid your taxes.
Yeah. Your
Your
farm's gone, but it's still getting taxed. I know.
Whatever you have left in your bag, give it to me.
Yeah. It's crazy.
Man, that's insane.
Yeah. So we just thought that was really, really interesting stuff. And as
we always talk about disasters, and it's like, you know, what is going to happen? How does the government stand during any of this, or do they have a plan? They sure do.
They do. And this is obviously just the tip of the iceberg.
It's insane how much information there is.
Like, we could go on for 3 hours on this
stuff. There's like books on Air Force One just in yeah. the details of how that all functions.
And exactly.
It's cool, though. It's pretty cool.
It's fun stuff. So, guys, thank you for listening. Make sure you're subscribed to the podcast. Make sure you follow us on Instagram, Facebook. Make sure you've subscribed to the YouTube channel because you can get this in video form as well. Yeah.
I think our next podcast will be back to kind of your our standard format of prepper stuff.
That's right. We just kind of wanted to deviate a little bit.
That was awesome. So,
you know, freshen it up a little bit. Good times. Anything else, Cameron?
Nope, I'm done.
All right, guys. See you next time.